The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Are you the serial killer known as John Doe?
That's for the jury to decide.
I saw him last
week.
Evening.
I'm looking for Simon. You know
what do you want with him? He paid his debt. Isn't that enough?
Do you know Simon Weeks?
He's done bad things, but he is not a killer.
Hello and welcome to the Crime Thriller Club, the show that brings you murder and mystery in every form from the big screen, the small screen and the written word. Coming up today, we join forces with the great Martin
Sheen. It's one of the most popular genres in books, on television and in the cinema. You can find it in pretty much every language under the sun, even though it didn't emerge as a standalone form until well into the 19th century. It's inspired great literature, but it is also true to say that there continues to be a snobbery towards the crime thriller, perhaps because it's just too popular. Tom Robb Smith went some way towards breaking that mould with the first crime thriller to be longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. That was Child 44, back in 2008. Tom is well established enough now not to worry about being pigeonholed, and is writing for TV too. It doesn't stop him getting excited about the work, as he told Lindsay Irvin after reading a passage from his sixth novel, The Farm, based on an unnerving real-life experience.
Until that phone call, it had been an ordinary day. Laden with groceries, I was walking home through Bermondsey, a neighbourhood of London just south of the river. It was a stifling August evening, and when the phone rang, I considered ignoring it, keen to hurry home and shower. Curiosity got the better of me, so I slowed, sliding the phone out of my pocket, pressing it against my ear, sweat pooling on the screen. It was my dad. He'd recently moved to Sweden, and the call was unusual. He rarely used his mobile, and it would have been expensive to call London. My dad was crying. I came to an abrupt stop, dropping the grocery bag. I'd never heard him cry before. My parents had always been careful not to argue or lose their temper in front of me. In our household, there were no furious rows or tearful fights. I said, "Dad?" "Your mother, she's not well. Mum's sick. It's so sad. Sad because she's sick. Sick how? How's Mum sick?" Dad was still crying, and all I could do was dumbly wait until he said, "She's been imagining things. Terrible, terrible things." A reference to her imagination, rather than some physical ailment, was so strange and surprising that I crouched down, steadying myself with one hand on the warm, cracked concrete pavement, observing a patch of red sauce leaking through the bottom of the dropped grocery bag. Eventually I asked, "For how long?" "The whole summer. Months and months, and I hadn't known. I'd been here in London, oblivious, my dad maintaining a tradition of concealment." Guessing my thoughts, he added, "I was sure I could help her. Maybe I waited too long, but the symptoms started gradually, anxiety and odd comments. We can all suffer from that. Then came the allegations. She claims she has proof. She talks about evidence and suspects, but it's nonsense and lies." Dad became louder, defiant, emphatic, no longer crying. He'd recovered his fluency. There was more to his voice than sadness. I was hoping it would just pass, and that she needed time to adjust to life in Sweden on a farm, except it got worse and worse. And now...
This is a complex novel, with stories within stories. But the basic kernel is pretty stark, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there is a very stark premise at the centre of the book, which is, who do you believe, your dad or your mum? And his parents have retired to a farm in Sweden, and he thinks everything's happy. This is meant to be an idyllic kind of retirement. And he gets a call from his dad saying his mother has been institutionalized, and she's very ill, she's psychotic, and he needs to fly over to Sweden straight away. Before he can take the flight, his mother has left the hospital. They don't know where she is for a while. Suddenly he gets a call from her saying, everything your father has told you is a lie. I'm not mad. I'm not ill. I'm not sick. Your dad is involved in a criminal conspiracy, and he's using the allegation of madness to cover up that conspiracy. I'm flying to London to tell you the truth.
Many people would think that the distinction between madness and sanity is pretty obvious. Your book takes a rather more complicated view, doesn't it?
This is based on something that happened to me. I mean, the opening concept boiled down is I experienced it 4 years ago. I got that phone call from my dad, and my mum had been institutionalized. I was flying out to Sweden. And so I did then, therefore, meet my mother in the airport. And I was absolutely convinced, as soon as I met her, I'd know instantly what was going on. It would all be very clear. And she looked more or less the same, had lost a little bit of weight, but she was very persuasive. She made perfect sense. And that phrase has stuck with me, making perfect sense. And so I realized this is something completely different. Everything I thought I knew was wrong. And that I was trying to evaluate something with no real understanding of actually what this was. In fact, everything she said, I believe, happened. Every single thing. It's just that I think she was piecing it together incorrectly.
That process of trying to leave the reader, that's still quite difficult to, quite a difficult technical feat.
Yeah, well, there are certain things you clearly can't do, which is, for example, have empirical bodies lying around. You know, if people were murdered, then they were murdered and you find them. You have to create a mystery that is quite a kind of delicate structure, that you look one way and it holds up, you look another way, it vanishes. That was the real, the art of it, if that doesn't sound too grand. That was the central problem that the book presented. I couldn't suddenly just ramp up the stakes by having a victim discovered in the woods, or, you know, suddenly you think, well, clearly she's not mad if someone was dead there. So everything is a question of ambiguity, of sort of perspective. And the challenge I think that presented was, in a sense, very exciting to deal with. Because one of the things I love about thrillers, actually that moment at the beginning of a thriller, and this is particularly true of Hitchcock, where there's this element of, is what's really going on there? You know, you look at
unease,
the unease
actually being particularly exactly
before
out.
It sort of crystallizes.
You might also wonder how something is what must have been very traumatic for you would begin to look like material for a thriller.
It didn't even dawn on me that it could be written as a book until my mum got better, and then she was just completely amazing, and the recovery was so quick, and she was it was quite inspirational whenever, in actually a very touching way. I mean, we were drifted apart a bit, and lots of the sort of damage that had happened in sort of early 20s had been healed. And suddenly all of that seemed very trivial, all the disagreements. And so it was quite a sort of rejuvenation for both of us, I felt.
Was piecing all the original experiences back together quite painful to write?
The actual relationship in this book is completely fictional, because my relationship with my mum was nothing like the one in this one. We had quite a kind of explosive family.
Which is totally the converse of the family in this story.
I didn't actually find it very difficult in terms of the, you know, in terms of that crisis. We had so many crises in our family that I didn't find that difficult. But I thought when I was fictionalizing it, that I kind of wanted to tell a story about someone growing up. That's the thing that struck me, that suddenly as a child you see your own life and you're quite kind of caught up in trying to find your place in the world, and you don't really pick apart your parents. It's quite an interesting process to reach that period in your life. When you start doing that, you look and think, wow, what did they go through? What scar tissue do they have?
And also about the parents who have secrets.
Stuff that's so buried. And it's wrong to talk about it as darkness. It's just about sadness and stuff that people don't necessarily explore with you. And I really wanted him to pick into that, because actually I think, you know, it can bring people closer. And so I think I just generally, as a rule, burying stuff down, I think, can be very destructive.
The setting for the novel is a remote part of Sweden on a farm. There was no anxiety for you about occupying a territory that was already well colonized.
You could get attacked as going down a path that seems to be well trodden. But then you think, well, the event took place there. I am half Swedish. You know, I know the landscape very well. It felt very arbitrary to move it to, say, Germany or the English countryside merely to duck a criticism that would be untrue anyway.
It is a kind of universal story in many ways, but there are some very specifically Swedish aspects to the story. Most prominently, I suppose, trolls.
I grew up sort of being told by my mum many, many troll stories and having them read to me. She didn't make them up, she would read them. This book is about a mother telling a child a story. It has that sort of being six and sitting in your bed and having your mum tell you a story. And so it felt right to fill it full of that kind of storytelling. And when I think about, I don't know, why you became a writer, which were the key influences, I used to love people telling me stories as a child. I mean, that's why I actually wanted the book to be read kind of in a compressed gulp. You know, I really hoped that you would feel that intensity because the original experience it was based on was 4 or 5 hours, I think, and we were sitting opposite each other. And I barely spoke. It was my mother speaking, and the most incredibly...
Because much of the body of this story is the sort of direct reported speech of his mother, isn't it?
Exactly. So there's two first-person narratives. There's his, which is in a sense quite a traditional first-person narrative. He's talking about events and he's giving his opinions. And then there's hers, which is just almost just like her dialogue yanked from the moment and stuck in the page. And it's not dialogue in an ordinary sense as we would be having. It's not a conversation. She's quite performative and she dominates, but it's still a pure... She's not imagining it as text. She's speaking to someone.
In what was considered a bit of a watershed moment with your first novel, Child 44, it was longlisted for the Booker Prize and, as you will know, shortlisted for the Costa and so on, which was kind of the first time quote-unquote genre writing had made it past the gatekeepers of high literature. Was that a happy moment for you to be considered sort of taken seriously?
It's funny, the genre debate, because it's so ingrained in the book world, as it's quite a, you know, let's be honest, it's quite a good way of getting on a radio show and you can talk about it. It seems to fire up real passions. I never quite got my head around it as one. I mean, a genre is just saying very clearly that this story is about a certain kind of feeling. I mean, you're saying this story is about fear and jeopardy and mistrust, which is why this story is a thriller. It's not saying anything else. It's not saying it can't be adventurous or experimental. There's no other parameters put around it other than kind of clear signal to the reader of the kind of narrative it is.
I suppose the people who look down on genre writing would suggest that it's all about constructing puzzles and the whole interest of the story is over once the puzzle has been solved and the pieces fit together in their right order.
But that isn't true in terms of you can have, for example, crime fiction where you know straight away who the killer is and you're following. It's a totally different story. I think that the number of possibilities are many within genre. If you look at, for example, movies and television, genre
which
does...
Which you work in, I understand.
Well, I mean, you just don't get anywhere near as much contempt as you do in books. You know, for example, you think of some really great movies that are clearly genre that have gone on to win the Oscar. And yes, drama does dominate awards in both film as well, but not anywhere near to the exclusivity that does in books. I just think there are no rules about this. If you can make someone read a 500-page book without a big narrative, with a, you know, a very small set of characters set in a very confined space, you know, there is an act of genius about that.
Tom Rob Smith talking to Lindsay Irvin, and The Farm is published by Simon & Schuster. From the already acclaimed to the newly discovered, Mark Pastor from Barcelona takes in influences from all around the world, from the US and the rest of Europe, and not just from books. But he's certainly the first to write crime thrillers in his native Catalan, using his experience as a police investigator. His fourth book, Barcelona Shadows, has now been published in English.
Moises Corvo sits to one side of the bed. On the wrinkled sheets, marked with other client stains, dried onto them weeks ago and giving off a stench of sex that floats around the room. Her body lies naked on the bed, curled into an S, with scratches on her back and two bruises on her inner thighs. Her hair is on the pillow, and her attentive gaze on Moises, without any trace of emotion, but also devoid of the fear she usually has after going to bed with whoever can pay for her supper. Moises Corvo treats her well as that big hunk of a man knows how, almost 6.5 feet tall and with a thundering voice, strong as an oak tree and arms long like a circus monkey. Giselle caresses his back while he dresses. He's already put on his trousers. The braces hang on either side, his shirt like a handkerchief in his gnarled hands. He turns his torso, and his mouth smiles in defiance of his deep blue eyes. His face is like an El Greco painting, with messy hair and eyebrows pointy as a notary's signature, and an aquiline nose as pronounced as his lower lip. "You're like the king," his wife tells him when he's home, and he's never sure if she's referring to his appearance or to his fondness for the ladies, the more naked and dissolute the better. "Are you coming tomorrow?" "Who knows? I may be dead tomorrow." "Don't say those things. Then don't ask silly questions." "I'm scared, Moises. I wish you were here more." "Scared of what?" "Not that scoundrel again, the one who..." Moises can't remember his name. Just the sound of ribs cracking beneath the vaulted arch of L'Arc de Théâtre. "No, I'm scared of the monster."
"The monster?"
His hand at his fly without thinking. "The streets are full of them. Children disappear. I'm worried about my Tonette."
"No child has disappeared, Giselle. That's just gossip from the old crones that hang around in doorways, sick of the gangs of youngsters shouting and jumping around."
There's a first introduction to a detective, a man of opinions and appetites, one might say.
Yes, you can imagine him as a cowboy. You remember Clint Eastwood, or I like to imagine him as Vincent Price, with the face of Vincent Price. He's a rude man. He's an investigator in Barcelona, and he's a rude man, and as the book says, he's like a dog. He's like a dog who defends his territory.
He's not a million light years from some of your own colleagues, presumably. You're a crime scene investigator in real life in Barcelona.
He's so far from me. He works in the same that I work. He's a crime investigator 100 years ago, as I am, actually, right now. But he's so far. He behaves so different that me and my colleagues behave today. But it's funny watching and trying to figure out how that detective was trying to resolve the crimes of a monster with the methods, with the abilities he had in his time.
This has been described as Catalan Gothic, which seems to be emerging as a genre in its own right.
Yes, I think it's the first Catalan Gothic, the book I know, because it's a merge of the influences from Robert Louis Stevenson, from Conan Doyle, from Bram Stoker. To the first chapter is about two body snatchers, and is directly inspired in the Robert Louis Stevenson tale, The Body Snatchers. I wanted to write something like that.
It's sort of playing with the idea of vampires, isn't it? The first corpse that Corvo finds.
I wanted to talk about the legend, not about the reality. I didn't want to talk about the real case exactly as it was. I wanted to make a fiction about how a vampire could behave in beginnings of the century in Barcelona. I wanted to talk about how people remember this case, about how people remember she was a vampire, she was a serial killer, she was a murderer. She has this environment of the Barcelona in the beginnings of the 20th century. She's got this gothic atmosphere, and it's like perfect for a vampire story. I wanted her to beat like a vampire, because she believed she
you're
was.
You're talking about the character, Enriqueta.
Yes, Enriqueta. She's the female serial killer, and she really believed she was a vampire. So I wanted to talk about a person who believes is a vampire and behaves like a vampire in the city, killing children, killing people, and drinking their blood.
And this is a true story. Was it based on a true story?
Yes, it's a true story. I didn't know that story. In 2004, I was listening to the radio and somebody was telling, And I began researching just for curiosity. I didn't mean to write a book. It was like, I gotta know more about this story. And everybody who hears about Enriqueta wants to know more and more and more because it's fascinating. She's so hypnotizing. You Google her name, you see her face, and she hypnotizes you like a cobra. But I didn't want to be like a journalist. I didn't want to write it, you know, that she made this, made that. I wanted to make a fiction about that. I wanted to make a gothic novel with an investigation that didn't exist. The Moises Corbo, the inspector, didn't exist. He didn't arrest her. She was arrested by accident. And I wanted to create that investigation, to imagine how an investigation would be in that Barcelona of 1912, and how a couple of cops would fight to chase a monster.
So you've set yourself quite a challenge for a crime novel, that we know who she was and what she did, and yet you've got to manufacture suspense and a sense of an investigation. How did you do that?
I like to think about my book as a chessboard. I have the chess pieces, that I know how they are going to move. I have the queen is Enriqueta, her husband is the bishop, and her lover is the knight, maybe. And then I introduce my own pieces, my own chess pieces on the chessboard. And I move my own chess pieces, respecting the original game, but trying to catch the queen too. And I think that works. I think that you know who is the murderer. It's not a whodunit. You know Enriqueta is killing people, but you don't know if Moises, is that chess piece, is going to finally catch her.
And you don't know as you go along who she's going to kill next, do you?
Yeah, and that's what I try to write to.
Let's go back to Corvo. Yeah. And we've said he's a sensualist, but he's also a great reader, and he's very contemptuous of Sherlock Holmes in particular.
A lot of people told me, okay, do the cops read? Yes, we read a lot. And Moises Corvo reads and compares reality with fiction. And he's very critic with fiction. I don't agree Corvo a lot. He thinks Sherlock Holmes is wrong. He thinks it's like, okay, Sherlock would never resolve any case in my city.
Mm-hmm. And at one point he actually disguises it. Passes himself off as Lestrade.
Yes, Lestrade. He's the policeman. Yeah. Sherlock is a detective, and Lestrade is the police detective. And Moises Corvo is a police detective, and he feels sympathy for Lestrade. He's always the one in the background. He's not the main character of Sherlock Holmes stories, but who arrests the murderers? Lestrade. So Moises Corvo feels like, okay, my nickname is Lestrade.
Is there any significance in the time in which you've set it, early 20th century?
Yes. It's like a Western movie, you know, like a spaghetti Western movie times in Barcelona, because there were a lot of gunmen. There were anarchists with guns shooting everywhere. And 3 years before the murders of Enriqueta, 3 years before she was arrested, there was the tragic week. It was a sort of revolution. A lot of people from Barcelona were recruited to go to Morocco, to the war, and people were so tired to send the young to Morocco to war, to die. It was a revolution. They took out the priest mummies from churches and they dropped them on the streets, and that was a big fighting. And 3 years after that, the city was still on fire. The fact that Enriqueta was in that city, it was like the monster was sleeping on a bed of gunpowder, and she had a lot of lighters with her.
Mark Pastor's Barcelona Shadows is published by Pushkin Press, and he's drawn a picture of the evil Enriqueta in my copy, brandishing a meat cleaver. Now, joining me is our own crime critic, Laura Wilson, who has written 11 novels herself. Laura, you were last on this podcast talking about your last but one D.I. Stratton novel, A Willing Victim. You've written one since then, haven't you? The rate of that you thriller writers write at is phenomenal.
Well, they do like us to be quite efficient. I mean, one a year is considered acceptable.
Do you think that's partly why there's a bit of snobbery towards the genre? Because you're just expected to keep churning and churning and churning them out?
I think it's maybe slightly that, but I think it's also, as you said earlier, if a lot of people like stuff, then it's obviously there's a feeling that it must be slightly down market and, you know, too enjoyable.
What are the tropes at the moment? I know we've been going through a real Gone Girl phase, haven't we, in the aftermath of Gillian Flynn's massive success. Can you trust your husband or your best friend?
Yes, there's been an awful lot of novels which have things on the flyleaf saying, how well do you really know so-and-so as your next-door neighbour or whoever it is? Well, for those of us who grew up with Daphne du Maurier and Celia Fremlin and this kind of thing, it does feel slightly like reinvention of the wheel, although obviously it's been given a new spin by the internet, where you can really be whoever you want to be. And there's a whole sort of virtual universe you can play with out there. But there have been a lot of these sorts of novels bobbing along in what you might call the Gone Girl slipstream. For my money, the best one that's come out really in the last year is A.S.A. Harrison's book, The Silent Wife, which is a wonderful portrait of a toxic marriage, really quite superb. Nothing else, I think, has quite sort of hit that mark. But that's not to say that something else won't come along, because it's a very, very rich seam.
And there's a lot of fusion stuff. I mean, you could say in a way that the Mark Pastor is fusion. Well, you know, we had Lauren Bucas, who's incredibly successful with The Shining Girls last year. And you picked out in your January column a novel by Jo Walton, Farthing, which is an SF crime crossover. What is this all about?
Yes, well, Farthing is an alternative history. It's what would have happened if we'd made a sort of peace with dishonour with Hitler in the first years of the war. I think it is partly a decision by the trade, publishers really wanting to have two bites of the cherry, that this could be science fiction, or it could be fantasy, or it could be crime, or it can be for all three, because they all obviously have elements of each other anyway. And I also think that because at the moment there are certain aspects of crime fiction, I would say that police procedurals are one of them, they've really slightly got into the doldrums. And I think it's also an effort to jazz it up and give it a bit of a USP, even if that means having a sort of giant spider in the middle of Piccadilly Circus or something. I think to some people, you know, Neil Gaiman and people like this, it comes easily and naturally and wonderfully. But I think with others, it's really striving for effect and just, well, going too far.
There is something about rigour, isn't there, among you purists, doesn't it? Does it outrage your purist souls have giant spiders in the middle of your plot?
I have to say it does a bit mine. I'm one of these people who always hated magic realism, because I think if you've just got the possibility of having usually a elderly Peruvian lady jumping over an office block, then you don't actually have to roll up your sleeves and think of a proper plausible plot with proper plausible psychology. And I do find that slightly irritating. Although if you do anything with enough panache and brio, you can get away with it. I mean, I think one of the things about crime novels is plausibility. And once you've established that, you can really tell them anything.
There is this sort of tidal wave of thrillers and crime novels coming in from other cultures and other languages at the moment, isn't there?
In some ways, that's good, because up until about 15 years ago, we really used to translate shamefully little, and not only of crime fiction. And there is snobbery towards the genre. And I think some people have a feeling that if you're reading it in translation, this confers some sort of literary merit. But I think now we've got the lot. I mean, we've got stuff that's set in Ulaanbaatar and, you know, Tasmania and all sorts of places. And actually, long may it last, because you do get different sorts of crimes in different kind of places. In Northern Europe, it tends to be the single transgressor. In places like Italy, it tends to be crimes committed by, not necessarily corporations, but many people. And they tend to reflect what is going on and what are the predominant fears of the society. And it's always interesting to see how the other half do it.
Mm-hmm. This Barcelona Shadows is the fourth Corvo novel. And so we're getting, you know, granted that it's successful and the others are published, we're going to be getting them backwards or in the wrong order. Does that matter?
Well, I haven't read Barcelona in the Shadows, and I can quite see that if the UK publisher deems that to be the strongest one, then that's the one they ought to publish first, because that will get people most interested. Where I think this becomes complicated is if the protagonist has a sort of narrative arc in their life, it can get quite confusing. A wonderful Swedish novelist, Håkan Nesser, is quite an extreme case. He's actually had a change of career in there for the protagonist. There's a novel by a French writer, Pierre Lemaitre, who had what in effect is the second novel. It's called Alex, and it came out last year. And now, Irene came out in the last month, which is the prequel, also with the pint-sized but wonderful Camille Verhoeven, who is a commandante. And that, because it's got a lot to do with, don't do a spoiler here, Laura, his personal life, shall we say, and it does have a great bearing on later, you do think, well, actually, I wish I'd read Irene first.
So what about the stuff that's coming up from closer to home? What are your tips for the spring reading? You were complaining of the terrible workload of the crime critic in spring, weren't you, a little while ago?
Do you know, it's indoors, no heavy lifting, and it's lovely, and you shouldn't complain. But in the
quite a lot of heavy lifting with the piles of...
Some of those Nordic noir things, that you know, they can knock out your dog if they get through the letterbox at the wrong angle, I tell you. Seems like in the last 6 weeks, from the 27th of February, which I think must be a sort of magic day in the publishing calendar, it's like, here comes everything. I think two very good debuts that I've read recently. One is Sarah Hillary's police procedural. It's called Somebody Else's Skin, and that's definitely worth the read. I mean, you've got the requisite baggage, which is, you know, the copper with the trauma in the past and the sidekick who's definitely got sort of superior outsider status, shall we say. But it's a very genuinely intriguing book about some really quite unsettling types, about domestic violence, all different kinds of domestic violence, and presented in a really very unsettling way, and has a really strong ring of authenticity, which I think is quite important. And it's the start of a series. Another book that was very good, which was published back in January, is Eva Dolan's first novel, Long Way Home. It's set in Peterborough, which is quite unlikely, isn't it?
But not if you know Peterborough.
One thing about Peterborough is that there are many immigrants there for all sorts of reasons, agricultural work and so forth, both legal and illegal. And it goes into this sort of shadow world with a policeman and a policewoman who are themselves both immigrants. And so you see it from both sides of the fence. People who we've come to know and love who are publishing this month include the first in a new trilogy, the Plague Times trilogy by Louise Welsh, wonderful writer. That is called A Lovely Way to Burn, and it's a crime story set against the background of a pandemic which is sweeping its way across the globe. There's also a new Belinda Bauer coming up, called The Facts of Life and Death.
She's very good on location, Belinda, isn't she? Her first novel really strikingly set on Exmoor, the amazing landscapes.
Yes, there was that. It began with that very good image of this little boy desperately digging holes on to try and find the body of the, I think it was the cousin, who disappeared. And he then ends up in correspondence with the man who killed him. And everything gets rather out of control for there. And it's a fabulous novel. It won the Gold Dagger a few years ago, and she's written quite a few others since, including a super novel called Rubbernecker about a young autistic man, which was shortlisted for the Dagger last year. There's a new Sophie Hannah coming up. She is also doing the Carry On Agatha Christie novel this year, but this is her own novel as Sophie Hannah. It's called The Telling Error, and it's coming out in April. There is also If You Can Bear to Wait Till May, which I have to say I kind of hardly can, because I love these. John Harvey, his wonderful detective, D.I. Charlie Resnick. It's billed very sadly as his last case. It's set in Nottingham, and Resnick investigates the disappearance of a woman who vanished during the miners' strike 30 years ago, and who has just, in corpse version, been uncovered.
Do you really think that John Harvey's going to stop writing, or is he just going to change genre?
I did ask him. I said, oh, come on. And he said, no, no, I think I've done enough now. But whether that means just crime or altogether, I'm not sure.
Is he one of those writers who doesn't like writing?
Oh, no. He seems to me, when he speaks about it, to genuinely love writing and be incredibly engaged with it. And I hope he changes his mind, because he's a wonderful writer.
So do I, Laura, so do I. Thank you very much for coming in. And thanks also to Tom Rob Smith, Mark Pastor and Lindsay Irvin. This week we've heard about the first crime novels written in Catalan, and next week I'll be reporting from South Korea on their literature, one of the world's best-kept secrets. Here's hoping that you're finding our researches across the globe interesting. If so, do tell your friends about us and do subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or SoundCloud. There's still more on our website at theguardian.com/books. And in this week's Guardian Weekly, you can find out why a warts and all autobiography has made the Norwegian writer Karl Ove Knausgård a global literary sensation. I'm Claire Armistead, and my producer is Tim Mabey. From the both of us for this week, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.